The failure of drug war is glaringly obvious to judges, cops, wardens, prosecutors, and millions more now calling for decriminalization, legalization, the end of prohibition. Let us investigate the Century of Lies.
Hello, and welcome to Century of Lies. I'm your host, Doug McVeigh, editor of DrugWarFacts.org. Jennifer Hess lives in Eureka, Kansas. She's a medical cannabis patient, as was her late husband, Homer Wilson. The circumstances that led to Homer's tragic death were an outrage perpetrated by local law enforcement. The situation in which Jennifer now finds herself is an even greater outrage that is again being perpetrated by law enforcement. I spoke with Jennifer recently. Here's her story in her own words.
On the evening of May 24th, it was about 10:30 at night, my eldest son, who's 15, had gone to bed already. My younger son, who is 11, and my husband and I were just sitting in the living room watching TV, minding our own business, and there was a knock at the door. Well, I didn't have my porch light working at the time, the bulb had burned out. I couldn't really see who was out there through the window, so I just cracked the door open. I wasn't fully dressed, so, I wasn't trying to show them everything, whoever was out there. And I opened the door. There were four Greenwood County police officers. They said that someone had reported screaming coming from my house, which there wasn't, and I let them know that there was no screaming coming from my house and went to close the door. At that time, they forced the door open. Two of them entered the house, and they demanded I go outside with the other two. So they made me go out there. I had asked them to just let me get a bra on, and they wouldn't even do that. So they ended up booking me kind of exposed. But anyways, they out there Mirandized me and cuffed me and would not let me back into the house for any reason. They had asked my husband some questions and apparently my son. And then they brought my husband out and cuffed and Mirandized him and booked us both in the jail. The jail conditions were absolutely horrible. There were nine women packed in a cell made for six women. We were sleeping on the floor, sometimes even blocking the doorway, which would seem like a fire hazard to me. And on the day of June 7th, I was getting ready to bond out, and the sheriff and a KBI agent took me into the interview room and let me know that my husband had had a medical emergency and didn't make it, and asked me questions about his health and habits. He did have mitral valve prolapse and hypertension and bipolar disorder and ADHD. Also had some issues with his ear. I think that's pretty much everything. He was not about to die before we went in. He was on several medications, mostly for blood pressure and on lithium. And at that time, after that, immediately I bonded out. And I've just been home by myself ever since. They took my children, and they're now placed with my sister for the time being. So that's pretty much what happened.
That's outrageous. So it's a made-up story. There's no probable cause. There's no warrant. You both end up in jail. And as you're getting ready to leave, you're told that your husband has died. Jesus.
Yeah. And there was the way that they deliver the news to me, there's just no humanity in it. None. There's no humanity in these police. They don't care whose lives they're destroying.
Has there been an autopsy? Did they determine a cause of death yet? Did a real pathologist do a medical examination?
I was told that the report would take about 90 days from time of death.
So you're still waiting to hear from.
Yeah, Right, and I would have to request that from the district court.
So you're being put through the system to fight trumped-up charges. They're trying to take, am I right, they're trying to take your children?
Yeah, they have taken my children. I'm here alone now.
Oh, God. Well, like, I mean, are they trying to make it a, are they, God.
Well, St. Francis, which is an organization, a religious organization, which has that separation of church and state, but they handle these kind of situations, and they're going to try to reintegrate them back into the home, but I'm looking at them being gone until December at the soonest.
Wow.
From what I'm told. That's a lot of time with my kids that I can't get back.
God, no kidding. Oh, Jesus.
And I can't be there for them while they're grieving the loss of their father. I'm the kind of person that just wants a simple domestic life and try to make myself as small as possible. And then these jackbooted thugs come forcing their way into my house, kidnap my children, take my freedom, kill my husband. So, you know, I can't do that. And I'm not, when it comes to injustice, I'm not one to keep my mouth shut, ever.
That was my interview with Jennifer Hess. She lives in Eureka, Kansas, and Jennifer Hess is a hero. Unfortunately, she cannot afford a private attorney, and so she has to rely on a court-appointed lawyer as she moves forward through this ordeal. Now, I wrote up her story for Freedom Leaf Magazine. You can get more information by reading that. You can find the link by going to my Facebook page at facebook.com/Douglas Allen McVeigh. That's facebook.com/DouglasAllanMcVay. You're listening to Century of Lies. I'm your host, Doug McVeigh. Now let's turn to that House Judiciary Subcommittee hearing on women and girls in the criminal justice system. The subcommittee chair is Representative Karen Bass, Democrat from California. Let's hear her opening statement.
I welcome everyone to today's hearing on women and girls in the criminal justice system, and I now recognize myself for an opening statement. I am very pleased that the subcommittee is holding this hearing today. After decades of policies that led to mass incarceration, we are finally at a point of examining the policies and the consequences. What has been missing from the discussion of criminal justice reform is the special and specific impact the tough on crime era has had on women and children. Today's hearing begins a discussion about women in the criminal justice system. It is critical that we understand how and why women become involved in the system, what happens to them when they are incarcerated, and what their trajectory is once released. We need to examine the impact of the war on drug-related policies that specifically targeted women in hopes of capturing men. What happens to families and especially children when women are incarcerated? We need to examine the special needs women have when they are incarcerated. What's different? What are their needs? What happens to their children while they're in the system and when they're released? For example, federal law can lead to termination of parental rights if the child of an incarcerated woman remains in foster care beyond 18 months. Some states have even shortened the timeline to 6 or 12 months. If a woman receives a sentence of 5 years, why should she face losing her children forever to adoption? Examining pregnancy while incarcerated is the most obvious difference. Specifically, prisons and jails are not designed or equipped to deal with the issues of pregnant women in custody. I'd like to recognize now Charlotte Cook. Wave your hand, please. While in prison, she complained that she was pregnant. The medical staff at the prison insisted that it was just because she was fat and stressed out. After much persistence, a blood test ruled that she was in fact pregnant, although 6 weeks into her pregnancy without prenatal care. She had complications, and her son was born a preemie at 4.5 pounds. 18 months later, he was diagnosed with severe autism. But the health needs of women, regardless of pregnancy, is different, and all women should have access to appropriate medical care. That includes access to gynecological care and not just during the childbearing years. So what is to be done? Through this hearing, we will learn the common reasons why women enter the criminal justice system. This testimony must inform our next steps on sentencing reform. The testimony of Ms. Kerman and Ms. Schenck will help us determine whether it is time to revisit our overly broad drug conspiracy laws, which tend to leave low-level offenders, commonly women, laden with the responsibility for actions they did not commit or sometimes didn't even know about. We must also consider methods of reviewing extremely long sentences, as the number of women serving life sentence is on the rise. One out of every 15 women in prison, nearly 7,000, is serving a life or virtual life sentence. While 80% of women in the criminal justice system are mothers, these life sentences do not only affect the person incarcerated, they affect the children who lose a parent. Thus, the conversation of incarcerated women must include a conversation about their children. The Urban Institute's research shows that staying in touch promotes positive outcomes for both the children and their parents, which often reduces recidivism. Communities must also be a part of the conversation. Teachers and staff should prioritize knowledge and sensitivity about issues children of an incarcerated parent face. Schools should spearhead efforts to meet the needs of children with incarcerated loved ones and offer resources or clubs targeted towards students who have been affected by incarceration, including support groups, counseling, extracurricular activities, providing opportunities to process experiences through poetry, writing, arts, and journaling. Perhaps if we do this, we can reduce the statistic that 50% of children who have a parent incarcerated wind up incarcerated later in life. Connections should be made with community programs and local service providers that serve families affected by incarceration for additional support. And finally, we cannot ignore the conditions of women in prison and the difficulties of their reentry back into communities after release. I hope to explore how we can improve conditions of women incarcerated to ensure that their most basic needs are met, including the needs of incarcerated pregnant women. Any facility that incarcerates women must be held to minimal standards of care. Today, women will no longer be overlooked in the criminal justice conversation. We must have an overall approach to criminal justice reform that specifically considers women. I look forward to hearing the testimony of our panel of witnesses and the opportunity to discuss these issues.
That was Representative Karen Bass. She was chairing a hearing of the House Judiciary's Subcommittee on Crime, Terrorism, and Homeland Security on the subject of women and girls in the criminal justice system. You're listening to Century of Lies. I'm your host, Doug McVeigh. Now let's hear from some of the witnesses who were there to testify. First, here's Jesselyn McCurdy, Deputy Director of the American Civil Liberties Union.
Thank you. Thank you, Chairwoman Bass. The American Civil Liberties Union would like to thank you and the ranking member Radcliffe for the opportunity to testify at today's hearing on women and girls in the criminal justice system. Prison is a women's issue. Lost in the sobering statistics on this country's prison population and the narrative surrounding mass incarceration is the degree to which women are ensnared in the criminal justice system. Over the past 30 years, the number of incarcerated women has grown exponentially. Again, women are the fastest growing segment of the prison population, increasing by 700% from 1980 to 2017, a rate twice that of men. Today, more than 200,000 women are incarcerated in jails and prisons across this country. The majority of women in prison are incarcerated for low-level offenses, most often property and drug-related crimes. Even as the rate of incarceration for women has risen dramatically in recent years, the percentage of women sentenced for crimes involving violence has fallen. Much of the growth in the women's prison population over the past 30 years can be attributed to the war on drugs. From 1988 to 1999, the number of women in state facilities for drug offenses grew by 888%. Drug and property offenses are often fueled by conditions of poverty, addiction, and untreated mental health issues, which is experienced by many women cycling through the criminal justice system. In addition to poverty, what often lands women in prison is their history of physical and sexual abuse, high rates of HIV, and substance abuse problems. When they participate in more serious crimes, including serious drug crimes and robbery, women are minor accomplices. When women commit homicide, they often do so in order to protect themselves from men who have abused them. Women of color are disproportionately represented in the population of incarcerated women. In 2014, black women were more than twice and Latino women were 20% more likely than white women to be incarcerated. Although the racial disparities among incarcerated women has narrowed over the past 15 years, the legacy of the disparity remains. Girls are more likely than boys to be in the juvenile facilities due to low-level status offenses or technical violations, and are far less likely to be detained for violent offenses. Women make up approximately 7% of the federal prison population, almost 13,000 women, compared to 1980, when there were 13,000 women in both state and federal prisons combined. More than 70% of the women sentenced in 2017 in the federal system were convicted of drug trafficking, fraud, or immigration offenses. In the same year, 68% of females sentenced had little or no prior criminal history. Furthermore, women frequently end up in federal prison due to federal drug conspiracy laws. Too often, federal drug conspiracy laws disproportionately punish those who unwittingly and unknowingly find themselves caught in the net of drug-related activity, even in a peripheral role. Women who are minimally involved in drug dealing, but who have partners or family members involved in the drug trade, can be required to serve long sentences as a result of conspiracy. Some of these relationships are abusive or coercive and leave women vulnerable and with few options. Women of color often find themselves subjected to prosecution based on their relationships and associations rather than their own personal conduct. Adding to the burden of women behind bars is that the majority of women in prison are mothers. Since 1991, the number of children with a mother in prison has grown 131%. The majority of these women are both custodial parents and primary financial providers. Further, mothers behind bars are 5 times more likely than men to report that their children are in foster care or cared for by the state. The very existence of parental relationships can be endangered when a parent is incarcerated. Incarcerated parents who have not abused or neglected their children are far likelier to lose their parental rights permanently than a non-incarcerated parent who has assaulted their child. Women are the fastest growing incarcerated population in the U.S., leaving far too many children and families without a mother, despite the fact that she is often their primary caregiver. Until we recognize the unique circumstances, needs, and consequences associated with women who come in contact with the criminal legal system, we will never truly address this nation's mass incarceration problem.
That was Jesslyn McCurdy, Deputy Director of the American Civil Liberties Union, testifying before a House subcommittee on the topic of women and girls in the criminal justice system. Now let's hear from Alex Castura, Legal Director, Prison Policy Initiative.
Thank you. Ms. Castura?
Thank you, Chairwoman Bass and Ranking
I'm
Member
sure Rack. Is your microphone on?
It says talk. Oh. Thank you, Chairwoman Bass and Ranking Member Ratcliffe and members of the subcommittee for providing me the opportunity to share some data on women's incarceration, not only because this is an issue that's been overlooked for far too long, but also because women's experiences in the criminal justice system serve to highlight the faults of the entire system. The U.S. incarcerates women at the highest rate in the world. So there's a lot of data to dig through, but as I outline the basics, I would like you to all keep one fact in mind. 1 in 4 women who are incarcerated have not been convicted. That figure alone demonstrates that we use incarceration far too much. Since the 70s, women's state prison populations have grown faster than their male counterparts. There are nearly 10 times as many women in state prisons now as 40 years ago. And despite this dramatic growth, women's incarceration remains an afterthought. And in most states, women have not benefited from recent efforts to reduce incarceration as much as men have. There are many complex and interconnected reasons why the U.S. is incarcerating women at ever-increasing rates. And here are a couple of examples. States still continue to widen the net of criminal justice involvement by criminalizing women's responses to gender-based abuse and discrimination. We've heard about the expansion of drug conspiracy laws that lead to even minor or peripheral roles of women receiving very harsh sentences, even more harsh than those in charge of the operation. But in terms of gender abuse, you have policy changes that led to mandatory dual arrests just simply for fighting back against domestic violence. And once caught in the net, there are fewer diversion programs available to women. In Wyoming, for example, there was a boot camp that allowed men to participate in a six-month program instead of having to serve a lengthy sentence. But no similar program is available in the state for women. So they face years of incarceration for first-time offenses, while their male counterparts can quickly return to the community. And then once women are incarcerated, they face more and harsher disciplinary sanctions for similar behavior when compared to men. And this disciplinary action harms women's ability to earn time off the sentence and decreases chances of parole. But the tentacles of mass incarceration have a long reach. Women incarcerated in jails and prisons account for just a small percentage of women under some form of correctional control. Probation accounts for the majority of women under correctional control and is often billed as an alternative to incarceration. But compliance with restrictive probation terms is particularly difficult for women. It often sets us up to fail. For example, probation comes with mandatory monthly fees, which women are in the worst position to afford, and failing to pay these fees alone is often a violation of probation. Childcare duties further complicate compliance because probation requirements often include travel to mandatory meetings or having to get advance permission for an emergency school pickup or advance permission for an emergency doctor's visit. And ongoing struggles with mental health and substance abuse disorders, which affect women in jails far more than men, require additional support rather than being viewed as punishment, rather than being punished as a failure of probation. And even as incarceration rates drop, women's incarceration continues to grow. Getting hard data is the obvious next step for policy change. And you would think that knowing how many people are locked, how many women are locked up, and where and why would be easy. After all, this is a population that's literally counted multiple times a day. But there's an astounding lack of data on women's incarceration. I set out to give a complete picture of women's incarceration in my report, Women's Mass Incarceration, The Whole Pie. And I had to weave together data scattered across incompatible government reports and surveys. And for example, the last time the Bureau of Justice Statistics published a comprehensive report on incarcerated women, it was 1999. That's 20 years ago. And since then, data on incarcerated women have been available piecemeal, scattered throughout BJS publications. But even worse, the BJS has stopped even collecting some data on women incarcerated, much less publishing it. When our statistical agencies are blindfolded, the policymakers are too. And having accurate, timely data is an important part of ending mass incarceration of women. But quite frankly, there is such vast room for improvement in so many areas that we can wait for data collections to catch up while we take common sense action today.
That was Alex Kastura, legal director of the Prison Policy Initiative. Now let's hear from Patrice Onwuka, senior policy analyst, Independent Women's Forum.
Ms. Onwuka, microphone.
Good morning. Thank you, Chairman Bass. Thank you, Ranking Member Ratcliffe. I work with the Independent Women's Forum, and we're an educational organization committed to increasing the number of women who value free markets and personal liberty. We advance policies that enhance people's freedoms and choices and opportunities. And so my focus, specifically, my work, focuses on expanding opportunity for women. This subject is something that's really important to us. So this is truly a great time of opportunity for women. We know that we have record low unemployment rates. Over 1,800 new businesses were started by women each day from 2017 to 2018. Firms owned by Black or women of color have triple-digit growth over the past decade. Yet, a criminal background locks too many women out of opportunity and economic mobility. Work is a critical component to the successful transition from the criminal justice system back into society. So I'm encouraged by the historic, bipartisan First Step Act that was passed and signed into law last year. It laid a foundation, but we know there's more to do for women. Conversations like today remind us that the left and the right are committed to helping every American achieve their right to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. Organizations across the philosophical spectrum are engaged in criminal justice efforts and for different reasons. And I think we can all agree that committing a crime and paying her debt to society should not preclude a woman from the pursuit of a better future. It's not just her future, but the future of her children, her family, her community that depend on her successful transition back into society. And it all starts with so many women who are in the criminal justice system. You've heard the statistics. They're staggering. But what's interesting is that we saw the replacement of judicial discretion with one-size-fits-all sentencing mandates, landing a lot of low-level nonviolent offenders in federal prisons for longer periods of time than otherwise they might have been given, and particularly because there are alternatives to serving time. Now, that not only impacted women, but their families. And as a result, you have more women are likely to have served as a primary caregiver to children prior to entering prison and have plans to return upon release. We know that children whose parents are involved in the justice system, they face a host of challenges and difficulties. Incarceration also forces families deeper into poverty and debt. The burden falls on family members, society, and yes, us taxpayers. The family bond, especially with their children, often become the motivating factor for women not to return to crime. So effective criminal justice requires respect for the dignity of all people and the successful means towards rehabilitation. Now, while serving time, women face special challenges. Some of the panelists have talked about this, from general health and wellness to ongoing gynecological care and prenatal care if they're pregnant. They require separate facilities for showering and using the toilet. Serving a criminal sentence, though, should not mean that female inmates serve in dehumanizing, unsanitary, unsafe, or unhealthy conditions. Some level of privacy from male guards is a reasonable expectation and can protect female prisoners, many of whom have experienced sexual violence. Incarcerated pregnant women are the most vulnerable. Unfortunately, the justice system really considers the special needs of this population. Thankfully, the shackling of women is a practice that has been ended by law because of the risk it poses to moms and babies. And now, as a mother of a 7-month-old baby boy, this is especially close to my heart. Ongoing physical and mental health care should not be forgotten. And when it's time for a woman to return to be released from prison, that is not the moment to begin thinking about what she's going to do afterwards. We know that women's recidivism rates are similarly troubling to those of men. About 1/4 of women released from prison have an arrest for a new crime within 6 months, 1/3 within a year, and 2/3 5 years out. So training, technical educational opportunities, including those tied to the faith community, can be assets in the rehabilitation and reentry process. There's evidence these programs work. The First Step Act encouraged rehabilitation programs and offers significant incentives to inmates to participate in recidivism reduction programs. And a strong economy is an ally in providing women opportunities. But where government puts up roadblocks to opportunity, government needs to remove them. We've seen that occupational licenses have been a tremendous hindrance for women who simply want to work. That's a place where we can start, and we're seeing states take some action there. The criminal justice system is an area where we all believe that smart reforms can help women who want to be productive members of society. So I look forward to today's discussion.
That was Patrice Onwuka, senior policy analyst with the Independent Women's Forum. She was testifying before the House Judiciary Committee's Subcommittee on Crime, Terrorism, and Homeland Security on the subject of women and girls in the criminal justice system. And that's it for this week. Thank you for joining us. I'm Doug McVeigh, and you have been listening to Century of Lies. We're a production of the Drug Truth Network for the Pacifica Foundation Radio Network on the web at drugtruth.net. We'll be back in a week with 30 more minutes of news and information about drug policy reform and the failed war on drugs. This is Doug McVeigh saying so long. So long! For the Drug Truth Network, this is Doug McVeigh asking you to examine our policy of drug prohibition, the Century of Lies. Drug Truth Network programs archived at the James A. Baker III Institute for Public Policy.